Have you ever thought about how a seemingly small technicality in the law could totally swing the outcome of a case?
Oh, absolutely. It happens more often than you think.
Well, today we're diving deep into Jolly v. State, a Florida Supreme Court case that really wrestled with this idea, especially where procedural rules and ensuring fairness collide.
Yeah, Jolly, decided back in 1981, it's a must-read, especially for anyone trying to grasp how the Florida appellate courts work.
Definitely key for anyone practicing law in Florida. So, Jolly v. State, it centers on the Florida Supreme Court and its power to review decisions that come from the District Courts of Appeal. And this is especially interesting given the 1980 constitutional amendment, which, you know, really attempted to fine-tune how that review process works.
Right. The amendment aimed to streamline things a bit.
Exactly. It's all about striking that balance, right? Making sure things are procedurally sound, but also making sure justice is served.
A tricky balance for sure.
So let me paint a picture for our listeners. We have this case, Jolly's Appeal, that goes up to the 5th District Court of Appeal. And they come back with a super short, like, one-line opinion, basically upholding what the lower court decided.
What we call a per curiam affirmance.
Right, a PCA.
To PCA, exactly.
Basically, they agree, but they don't give a whole lot of explanation as to why.
Just a quick, yep, we agree.
Precisely. But here's the kicker. The only reason they gave for affirming was a citation to another case, Murray v. State. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. Murray v. State itself was, at that very moment, under review by the Florida Supreme Court.
Talk about adding a layer of complexity.
So hold that thought for a second, because to really grasp why the Supreme Court looking at Murray was a big deal, we need to dig into the legal issue at the heart of it all. Murray, it dealt with a disagreement between two district courts of appeal, the 5th and the 1st, and it was all about whether certain jury instructions were mandatory, like did they have to be given or was it more discretionary? And the Florida Supreme Court had actually already stepped in on this very point in a case called Toscano v. State.
Right. Toscano laid down some guidelines on this whole jury instruction thing.
Exactly. So you have Jolly's case being decided based on a case, Murray, which itself was being scrutinized by the highest court in the state, and the issue they were looking at in Murray had already been addressed in Toscano.
Layers upon layers.
It's a real legal onion. But before we peel back those layers, I want to make sure everyone's with us on this PCA thing. So a PCA, just to recap, it's basically a quick, unanimous decision from the appellate court. They're all on the same page, but they don't give you a whole long written explanation as to their reasoning. Now, what makes Jolly even more fascinating is the timing. Remember, this decision came down after that 1980 constitutional amendment we talked about earlier. That amendment, to try and streamline things for the Supreme Court, generally limited their jurisdiction, meaning they couldn't just review any case they wanted to.
It had to fit certain criteria.
Right. And a big one was that there had to be an express and direct conflict between rulings from different district courts of appeal. It's like they had to be directly contradicting each other for the Supreme Court to step in.
You need that clear clash of legal interpretation.
Absolutely. So the million-dollar question in Jolly became this. Did the 5th District's reliance on Murray, a case that was already under review by the Supreme Court, did that meet the express conflict bar needed for the Florida Supreme Court to then take up Jolly's case under these new, more limited rules?
It's a really nuanced jurisdictional issue.
It really is. So what did the Florida Supreme Court decide? Did they consider that citation to Murray to be a sufficient express conflict?
Well, the majority on the court, they decided, yeah, citing a case that's already under their review, that does create what they called prima facie express conflict.
Prima facie? Now, there's a legal term we haven't thrown around yet today.
It essentially means at first glance.
Right.
So it means there's enough evidence on the surface to suggest there's a conflict, unless someone can come along and prove otherwise.
Uh-huh. Interesting. So citing a case that the Supreme Court is already looking at is, at first glance, enough to suggest there might be a conflict between different courts.
Exactly. And to really nail this down, the court then came up with a two-part test for figuring out if they had jurisdiction in these PCA situations where the only reasoning given is a citation to another case.
Two-part test. Okay.
First, they ask, was the case that was cited, was it actively being reviewed by the Supreme Court when that PCA was issued? Or second, had the Supreme Court already overturned that cited case by the time the PCA came out? If either of those is true, then boom, the Supreme Court says we have jurisdiction.
So the timing is crucial. It's all about when the district court made its decision relative to what the Supreme Court was doing with the cited case.
Absolutely. The timing is key.
So they lay out this two-part test, but why? Why did they feel the need to go beyond just a strict reading of what express conflict means?
Well, they were really concerned about ensuring consistency and preventing what they called inequitable treatment. Their thinking was you could have two people in very similar legal situations, but they end up with totally different outcomes simply because of when their appeals happened to land in relation to what the Supreme Court was doing with the relevant precedents.
So someone appeals just before the Supreme Court overturns a case and they get one result. Someone else appeals right after and they get a completely different result, even though their cases are essentially the same.
Exactly. And the court saw that as fundamentally unfair.
It really does seem like a fairness issue at its core.
It is. And the court even said, quote, "Common sense dictates that this court must acknowledge its own public record actions in dispensing with cases before it."
They're basically saying, look, we can't just ignore what we're already doing or what we've already decided when these lower courts are citing cases that are right in the middle of all that.
Exactly. They have to take their own actions into account.
Makes total sense. But as with many legal issues, there were dissenting opinions in this case. What did the justices who disagreed with the majority have to say?
Right. Justices Boyd and Alderman, they weren't on board with this whole thing. Their big concern was that this 1980 constitutional amendment, it was designed to put the brakes on the Supreme Court's jurisdiction, right? To make it more limited.
Strand it in a bit.
Exactly. They thought the court should really be focusing on those big picture cases, the ones that have statewide implications, the ones that are setting major legal precedents, not just individual claims of, hey, this might be unfair.
So their argument was that the majority's decision to create this exception for citation PCAs, it was like a loophole that could potentially swallow the rule.
Precisely. It undermines the whole point of limiting the court's review power. Justice Boyd even said, quote, "The court today is opening the gate the voters thought they had firmly closed."
So they're worried that by trying to address a fairness issue in one specific situation, the court might be inadvertently creating a flood of appeals down the line.
Right. They thought it could open the floodgates.
And then you had Justice Adkins concurring in the result only. What does that tell us?
Concurring in result only usually means that the justices agreed with the final decision. In this case, that the Supreme Court did have jurisdiction to hear Jolly's case.
Right.
But they probably got there through a different line of reasoning than the majority. We don't have the specifics from our sources, but it indicates that even though they all agreed on the outcome, there might have been some disagreement on the exact legal logic used to get there.
So even within the court itself, there were some different perspectives on how to approach this issue.
Absolutely. Different ways of looking at the same problem.
So we've dug into the procedural nitty-gritty. We've explored the different judicial philosophies at play here. But for all of our listeners out there, especially the future legal eagles, why is understanding Jolly v. State so crucial? Why does this matter?
Well, Jolly, it really brings together some foundational legal concepts that every lawyer needs to know. Well, first off, it highlights jurisdiction. A court's power to even hear a case. It's like, can they even decide this issue? That's fundamental. And then there's stare decisis, which is all about following precedent. What have courts decided in the past, and how does that apply to the case at hand? And Jolly shows us that even something as seemingly simple as citing a case can have huge implications.
Like dominoes.
It's all connected. And perhaps most importantly, Jolly shows us this ongoing tug of war between sticking to the rules and making sure things are fair. You have these strict procedural guidelines, but sometimes those guidelines might lead to results that feel, well, unjust.
And the courts have to grapple with that.
Exactly.
So for all those future lawyers in Florida, the takeaway from Jolly is that you can't just blindly cite cases. You have to know where those cases stand in the grand scheme of things.
Right. You have to be aware of what the Florida Supreme Court is doing, what they've already decided, and what they're currently considering. It's like citing a case that's under review by the Supreme Court. That could open up a whole new avenue for appeal.
So do your research.
Always do your research.
Absolutely. And, you know, Jolly really sheds light on how the Florida Supreme Court views its own power, its own jurisdiction, especially after that 1980 amendment.
Right, that amendment changed the game. And Jolly helps us see how the court is navigating those new boundaries. It's essential knowledge for anyone working within the Florida legal system.
And it underscores that the court's role isn't just about blindly following the rules, but also about making sure things are fair and consistent, especially when lower courts are relying on precedents that are themselves being questioned.
It's a balancing act.
It really is. Now, I know we've talked a lot about Murray v. State, which was the case that was cited in Jolly's PCA, but our outline also mentions Toscano and Jenkins. How do those cases tie into all of this?
Oh, yeah, good catch. Well, Toscano v. State, that's the case that really kicked off the whole conflict that led to Murray. It's the one where the Florida Supreme Court set those guidelines for jury instructions. So Murray was basically trying to figure out how to apply what the Supreme Court said in Toscano, and then Jolly's case gets caught up in the middle of all that.
Uh-huh. So it all goes back to Toscano.
It does, in a way. And then you have Jenkins v. State, which is another important case because it directly deals with the limits on the Florida Supreme Court's jurisdiction, especially after that constitutional amendment we've been talking about. It's like it sets the broader legal stage for Jolly, showing us how the court is working to define its own power of review after those changes came in.
So Toscano is the root, Murray is the branch, and Jolly is the leaf, so to speak.
That's a good way to visualize it.
And Jenkins is like the whole tree.
The whole legal landscape.
Perfect. So to sum it all up for our listeners, Jolly v. State shows us the Florida Supreme Court walking a tightrope. They have this constitutional mandate to limit their jurisdiction, but they also can't just turn a blind eye when there's a possibility of injustice. And it gets especially tricky when the lower courts are basing their decisions on cases that are themselves being reviewed or have already been overturned by the highest court in the state.
It's all about finding that balance.
Exactly. Now, I want to leave you, our listeners, with a thought to ponder. Do you think, given all this, given the need for the courts to be efficient and the need for fairness, do you think Jolly strikes the right balance?
It's a question worth considering. And how might understanding these jurisdictional intricacies affect how you approach your own legal work here in Florida?
That's the real takeaway here. And if you're looking to explore this even further, I highly recommend checking out Jolly v. State itself, along with Toscano, Jenkins, and Murray. Really understanding how these cases and these legal concepts all connect, that's going to be invaluable as you navigate the legal world.